Hi, everybody. It's Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles Stories of the Supernatural. And today I have Mr. Kevin McQueen, who's a prolific author of true crime stories. He compiles books about different true crimes, but he does the ones that I love the best, which are olden days, you know, when every, like the Age of Innocence, until you find out there was a lot of people that were anything but innocent. But before we get there, I'm going to bring him on and I'm going to let him tell you guys about himself. But he has, these are true crimes, which is the best part as far as I'm concerned, because we all get caught up thinking that what happens nowadays when we hear about these serial killers or people that do horrible things, it's like, oh my God, it's never been as bad as this. And guess what? Yeah, sometimes it has been. So let me get him on here. Hey, Kevin, how are you doing today?
Hi, Marlene. I'm fine. How are you?
Fantastic. Before we get going, I have a slide there with some of your books, even though I know you've written quite a few. And I know that you also teach, right? Is that correct?
Yes, I teach English composition and world literature at Eastern Kentucky University.
Okay. All right. Which, of course, that's why you're an author. It's difficult to be in those fields and not want to write. How did you ever start writing in this genre, per se? What was it that interested you about that?
Well, I was always interested in historical true crime and true ghost stories, mm-hmm. Supernatural kinds of topics. Okay. And where I really got started, I would love to write fiction. I've never been able to write fiction, though. I just don't seem to have the imagination for it. So I like to take incidents that really happened and try to retell them in a creative sort of way. But I was a tour guide for several years at a place called Whitehall near Richmond, Kentucky, which is a huge mansion built by an emancipationist named Cassius Clay, and the place is allegedly haunted. So I worked there for a number of years as a guide, and there had been a few books about him, a few biographies and histories, but they struck me as being a little out of date. And I'd been hearing all these stories about him from his family members that would come through, and we had old letters written by him that had never been published, so I had all this new information about him, and I thought I'd write a book about him, and I did back in 2001, and it turned out to be my first book.
Wow, that's great. But you know, that's fantastic, because you, like you said, you were a tour guide there, so you had access to, I imagine, a lot of things that's perfect as far as research is concerned to writing that book. And like you said, I believe it has that Whitehall does have a reputation of being haunted, right?
Yes, it does. And one thing I did in two of my books, I included some stories about the house, some ghost stories about the house.
And I know you were a tour guide, and I know tour guides, because they're there at all hours, or especially before and after the crowds get there, that they're sometimes the ones that witness the most. Did that ever happen to you? Did you ever hear or see anything when you were touring as a tour guide?
Well, I never actually saw anything myself. It seemed to happen to some of the other guides, and often we would have tour groups that would see interesting things.
Okay.
But apparently I'm not really sensitive to these things, because I never really saw much. No apparitions or anything. I saw strange things like swinging guide ropes, for example.
You know what? A lot of people think that when you witness something, it has to be something dramatic, like you said, like, you know, I saw a full body apparition. But sometimes being a tour guide, when you see things like that, anomalies, when you're saying, okay, you know, even something as basic as a swinging rope, where you really, if you think about it, you can't think of a plausible explanation why it would be doing that. That does fall into that.
Anytime something like that would happen, I would always check it out to try to find out why it happened.
Okay.
We often heard weird things. I did hear some things. Okay. Sometimes, I don't know how to describe it, but just sort of olfactory smells would take place. Mm-hmm. Some explainable, some not. Mostly I heard things, if anything were to happen to me at all, but I never really saw anything. Each time, though, I would try to check it out, though, to try to see what the cause was.
Right. And you know what? And I understand, and which is great, but that happens a lot. You know, sometimes places that are large and old, you're going to have noises. So you can say, okay, that was the wind, you know, a bird. I mean, there's a million plausible explanations. And even though you went and you checked it out, you know, it could or it could not. But still, it's easier to, how can I say, keep on working there and not have one of those encounters where I've heard of people that work at certain places and that's it. They have an experience which basically they turn in their letter of resignation the following day. But I think that's a fantastic basis for that first book. So what happened? You wrote that first book. Obviously, you were a tour guide there. You had all this information. And then from there, what, you wrote about that area in where was it, Richmond? Or did you go to some other location as far as what you wanted to write the next book about?
Well, my first few books were all about Kentucky, which is where I live. And then gradually I branched out and wrote a couple books about Indiana.
Okay.
And then I did one about the entire South. And now I'm working on some that are coming out fairly soon. I have two coming from Indiana University this summer, one covering the Midwest and one covering California.
Right, yes, I saw that one in California. I think it's supposed to be released, in a couple of months or something,
In August.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact date, but sometime in August.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully I'll have two more out next year covering New England and the Western states.
Okay. And, you know, I know, and I, like I was saying, you know, when I started the show, which is I love true crime, but I especially love true crime, especially like what you're writing about, which is, you know, everybody thinks of the good old days, you know, when people didn't do horrible things or,
well,
you know.
They need to get an old microfilm machine and look through a few old newspapers, and they'll be surprised.
And that's what made the papers. I bet there was stuff that never even made the papers because people sometimes, especially in communities, I imagine they wanted to hush it up, even though back then I know newspapers were like, sometimes they did exaggerate a little bit. But, yeah, it's a real eye-opener. And especially the kind of crimes that were committed, they could be pretty bad as far as the things that people did.
No, there's nothing new. It's all been done before.
Yeah, they don't have a... In other words, if you took that person and you plucked them out of, let's say, 1890, and you put them into 1990 or 2009, you know, we'd be hearing or, you know, seeing something on the internet about who they killed or wiped out or something along those lines, because...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, you know, when you were doing your research, and it sounds like you said, the only source back then were newspapers as far as... You know, documentation, maybe some books, I imagine.
A few books, some court records.
Okay.
Birth certificates, death certificates. There's quite a few things out there, but mostly what I get comes from old newspapers.
Now, and I know that back then, especially, like you said, what made the papers was when it involved a prominent or well-known family that was supposedly respectful, you know, respectable families that... You know, sometimes they were looked up as the, you know, they did no wrong, and then truth comes out. They were pretty wrong.
Those are usually the most interesting stories.
Yeah. And what do you think, what was part of it? Do you think it was because of their social status that they were able to get away with things for a certain amount of time, or how do you think that comes about?
I'm sure social status had a lot to do with it, yes.
You know, that things were hushed up until something finally happened that just could not be covered up anymore.
The things usually come out eventually.
And as a matter of fact, because I was looking through some of your things, I was looking through, I love this. I think it was one of the ones that you wrote out of Old Louisville. It was in Old Louisville. Something about the guy that his last name was Wing, and he came from a prominent family, and his wife was prostituting herself, and I was like, huh? I was like, what? So, I mean,
she came from a good family, too.
Yeah, which makes
They were both from very prominent communities and very prominent families, yet she ended up a prostitute. He ended up murdering her, so...
Yeah, and it makes you think, you know, you always think of people ending up like this to be like from the lower, you know, the echelons of society. And here these are two well-born, well-educated, supposedly members of society, and they're like engaging in the worst behavior. And well, like you said, he killed her. And so that goes to show you that was. That didn't preclude from for people taking a left turn in their lives. And I saw something also that his own brother had also killed somebody else, right? I mean, the whole family was kind of like, eh.
Yeah, one of his brothers did, and I think another one committed suicide. So
Yeah, okay. That well,
obviously there was a violent streak in the
yeah,
family.
they were troubled. That's a nice way of putting it. I also there's another book that you wrote, which was the one about the Axeman from Hell, okay, which I thought, well, I think all of them are interesting, but to me was, you know, when you that a lot of people don't realize that back in those days, having a, I guess an axe or a hatchet was very commonplace in households, and as gruesome as it sounds now, for somebody to go in there and kill somebody, in that story, where somebody was, what was it, New Orleans or no?
Yes, so it was New
It
Orleans.
was New Orleans, right? Where they had Italian families being targeted.
Italian grocers and their
Okay.
families. So this is one of the uncaught serial killers from American history who's really creepy and really terrifying.
And they, like you said, he went in there and they never, besides the fact that they never caught him. I guess they could never explain why he was targeting Italian grocers, of all things.
Hard to say, very hard to say. For years and years, basically, people have been saying, well, he must have had some kind of grudge against Italians, but judging from what we know about serial killers now, he probably was an Italian
Yeah.
because they tend to sort of hunt among their own ethnicity.
Right. Like he had
Groups
something.
that they're comfortable with.
Right, that
He
there
was
was
really
something there
scary.
that he was acting out, like, you know, who knows what it could have been. It could have been a million things that he was resolving in his sick head, and
True, it was
because
never caught,
it
so we'll
stopped just
never
as
know.
easily as it started, right?
Well, I'm sorry.
It just stopped. It from what I understand, he did it. He killed these families, and from what I understand, he the kind of the area was terrorized, right? They were like.
Oh, yes, they were. Very strange for serial killer. Generally, they go after one gender, one people of a particular age. He didn't really care. Once he got into someone's house, he'd go after men, women, and children, just whoever he could, anyone that he could kill.
So he was more interested in like or either that or what they, because they're so cold-blooded, is no witnesses, you know. Even, you know, it's like
Yeah.
wrong place, wrong time, out of here.
So he did leave some witnesses,
Oh,
so
he
we know
did.
just a little bit about what he looked like, but not much, not much. Real
And
creepy, creepy
how
story.
long did that, how long was he killing? What, do you remember how long it took those crimes?
Well, as you say, he stopped abruptly. If
Right.
I'm not good at remembering details off the top of my head. I believe he started around 1908, kept it up for a couple years, stopped for a while, then came back in 1916 and kept on till about 1918.
And you know
Assuming
what?
it was all by the same person. A woman named Miriam Davis has written a really, really good recent book about the subject, and she clears up a lot of misconceptions about the case.
Okay. And you know what? And when you and the reason why I asked you was, and you answered it, was that he did some killings, he stopped, and then he came back. And we even have more modern serial killers that do something like that, where they lead the double life, and if their personal lives are okay, they kind of like stop killing. And then if something happens to them in their personal lives, or, you know, something
Yeah,
that impacts them, then they
what
just,
they call a trigger or a stress,
right.
like losing their job or something.
Or something like that. And it makes you wonder if this guy was one of those, whether was it that he left town and he came back,
It's possible.
or was it that he was married and had a family and did appeared to be anything but what he was, and then something happened to him personally and he he took up where he left off.
Could be. We'll never know, I'd say. One good theory is that he possibly went to jail for a while.
Sure.
For something unrelated, and nobody, of course, knew exactly what he was or who he was. And once he got out of jail, he just continued right where he left off. Then the mystery becomes, why did he stop? Because, as with Jack the Ripper, all of a sudden it comes to an end, and no one has any idea why.
Right. Looking at it from the practical point of view, you know, so many killers or so is because they talk. You know, they get jailed and then they talk. Oh, I did this, or, you know, that murder, I was the one that did it. And then there's the smart ones that just never say anything to anybody.
That's
even
true.
Even if they're incarcerated, they never tell anybody. They don't want to own up to it, like, because they don't have anything to prove. And then, like you said, if it's something minor, they get back out. They don't have a cellmate that can say, hey, you know, when that guy was here, he told me he did this, this, and that, which a lot of these murderers, that's how they get caught. Because
yeah, they just have an instinct to talk or boast.
Yes, yes, and some of them absolutely
people just can't seem to keep their mouths closed about anything like this that they do.
Oh,
Ms. Davis has a very interesting theory that he actually might have been a burglar, a professional burglar, which mm-hmm. was how he got in and out of these houses so well. And it's possible he was sent up for burglary for a few years.
Yeah. In other words, he would burglarize sometimes but somewhere along the line, he had to feed his appetite for killing, because from what I understand, when he killed these people, he was just in there to kill them.
He would make it look like a burglary gone bad. He'd go through drawers and he'd open boxes and that sort of thing, but he never or very, very seldom ever took anything. It was just plain to everybody that he wanted to make it look like a burglary.
But it wasn't.
But he was there for something else.
Right, and the fact that he was targeting that ethnicity, that of course speaks to more than just I need some money or I want to, you know, get some stuff and fence it. And as a matter of fact, now they're coming out, I believe they're going to have some type of special or documentary where they're trying to tie in H.H. Holmes to Jack the Ripper, you know, and I haven't seen it. I don't know how they're basing it. Or, you know, how they're tying it in that basically H.H. Holmes went to London, committed the murders as Jack the Ripper, and then came back, which is why supposedly he suddenly stopped. You know, the murder stopped, just like what you described. Which is another theory I've heard of, that sometimes it's just that they actually move away. They leave town. They go to another part of the country. And sometimes, not, you know, especially back then where there wasn't so much communication, where people sometimes have picked up on very similar murders or the
yes, it's true.
In another part where they say, okay, this might be, and I understand back then they didn't have forensics like they do now with DNA match and all those things, but when they get that type of system of killing, and from what I understand, back around that time, there was quite a few murders with people being killed by an axe. Well, Lizzie Borden, that's one of the most famous ones. But there's another one that you have that you wrote about. It's the Servant Girl Annihilator?
Oh, right, in Austin in around 1885, I believe it was, 1885, 1886.
Okay, but he got caught, right?
No, he actually was never caught either.
Really? He wasn't caught either? Oh, boy.
No. I think it was probably easier to get away with it back then.
Oh, sure. And what was it? I believe, because I just very lightly, what was it? His target was girls that were like...
Well, his targets were mostly, at least at the beginning, maids, housemaids, servants who would live in outdoor quarters. But then toward the end, he actually killed a couple of society, or at least middle-class women.
Okay.
Were not servant girls.
Okay.
And then he disappeared. So there's another one we'll probably never really know the true story.
Exactly. Because, because I know that a lot of times the servants would be housed like maybe on the top floor of a house. But, yeah, like you said, if they were housed outside of the main house, they would have been much easier targets. then, yeah. And I imagine that people probably took a paid more attention once he switched from servants to non-servants, because unfortunately that's the way it was back then, you know,
Yeah,
or
the community seemed quite sympathetic to the poor servant girls getting killed, but there wasn't really a massive panic in town until he killed the last two victims.
yeah, then it was
And
like,
then he disappeared. So I don't know, possibly the heat was on him so badly that he left town, which is actually my own theory.
that what he left town because he what that he knew he was about to get nabbed, or
Possibly, or there was such a police presence afterwards that I think he just simply left town and continued killing somewhere else.
okay, all right, because
But again, we'll never know, really, probably.
and they took it, and that's another thing. You know how some of these killers supposedly they have these deathbed confessions where, you know, they're gonna die, so they fess up and they say, "I'm the guy that murdered." We've never heard of anything like that, where nobody's ever come forward and, you know, actually admitted to any of those killings, which,
No, not as far as we know.
you know what, which tells me, you know. And to me personally, I think those are the scariest ones because, like you said, they don't boast, they don't have anything to prove. They know how to basically, in their mind, separate. This is how I could easily get caught, so I don't have to prove anything. They're just complying and feeding their own internal monster, and that's all they care about. And they
That's
never bother to either boast to anybody or even make a deathbed confession. They got what they wanted. And I think that sometimes, you know, that's why it becomes such a mystery.
I think so too.
So when you were doing any of this research, Kevin, and I know that, did you come across any that basically, once you did the research, devolved into that there was some type of paranormal events that took place tied into what happened?
I can't think of any really dealing with historical murders. Now, I
Okay.
found a number of other paranormal ghost story type articles that I would use in other books.
Okay. Did you come across any? Because I know when I've read some of these, especially these older ones, you could tell they're more like urban myths or, you know, oral tradition. And very rarely did I ever hear one that I could say, wow, this sounds like this is legitimate. Even though I know around that time, the ghost stories, like from, you know, the Christmas time, ghost stories, Victorian was very popular. Did you ever come across one that when you read it, you said, wow, this sounds plausible? Doesn't sound like a made-up story, in other words.
Well, that's the problem with looking at the old newspapers. Obviously, we have no way of really checking and seeing if all those stories are true. We just basically have to take the newspaper's word for it. So we don't know if the witnesses were correct. We don't know if they were making up stories. We don't know if the newspapers were making up hoaxes to entertain readers.
Right.
So while the stories are a lot of fun, I always say, keep in mind, there's really no way to check up on these things. We simply have to take their word for it.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying. Some of them, when you read them, they're like, oh. And then others, you know, like you said, without being able to actually, you know, verify how truthful the witnesses were, some of them, when you read them, you know, they sound like, wow, this sounds like, you know, even
Well,
though it
it
happened
sounds
over 100
pretty
years
plausible.
ago.
Some of them do sound pretty plausible. Of course, now we have a more scientific way of investigating these things.
Well, you
But
know,
some stories sound pretty reasonably possible.
but you know what, Kevin, this is what I found, because, you know, I've done paranormal work on the side, and it's different when you go out there and, yeah, you've got all this equipment, all this stuff that people lug around today, whatever, to try to capture and, you know, and analyze any type of paranormal phenomena. You know, there's just a lot of things that happen to people when they're not, first of all, they're not investigators, or they're not prepared to capture anything. It just happens to them, you
That's
know. They're at a certain place at a certain time, and they witness something. And they're not there to capture any evidence, or they're not expecting to see anything, but it doesn't take away from the fact that what happened is actually truthful, or that there's some type of supernatural agency behind it, you know, even if they can't explain it. And that happens to a lot of people. You know,
yeah, the stories that I always found impressive came from people who weren't looking for ghosts.
Yeah.
People who are actually skeptical or downright disbelievers mm-hmm. in the paranormal, and they'd still see something strange.
Yeah. In my book, I tend to believe them more. You know, when they say, I had this experience, and even now I can't. And some of them will tell you, I'm still a skeptic, but I still can't explain what I saw or what I witnessed or whatever.
Yeah, the case I think those are good witnesses, really.
Yes, those are excellent. Because they, like I said, they kind of like tripped over it. Or they were just at the right place at the right time. And like, you know, for instance, about a couple of months ago, I was interviewing a paranormal team. And one of them, he tells me when he was much, much younger, he was a soldier, and he would do guard duty on a tower. And this was in Germany. And he said that one day, basically, you know, you had to take the stairs down to get off that tower. And he hears steps thinking that it's the guard that's supposed to come in and take over for him. And when he comes out, he still is hearing the steps, but there's nobody there.
Interesting.
And he said that he felt so overwhelmingly bad. He kind of basically said that if that tower would have been lower to the ground, he probably would have vaulted instead of going down those stairs to pass whatever it was that was coming up the stairs that, you know, sounded like somebody doing guard duty with the boots. And then later on, he talked to some other people, some other guys, other soldiers, and they kind of all told some version of this very similar experience. As to who it was, they never knew. And, you know, back then he was a young guy. He was just a soldier hanging out doing guard duty. And the next thing you know, he has this experience, which even now he can't account for. But he'll say, you know, this was not like, oh, I think I kind of heard something. He says it was distinctly somebody coming up with boots to the guard tower where he was waiting at. You know, so things like that tells me that, you know, even though sometimes, you know, it can't be explained, there's got to be something out there, you know, that just...
Well, I think someone like that would be a good witness, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And
because
let me ask...
he's familiar with that sound, he knows what that sound is.
Exactly. Exactly. Like I said, this was not somebody that's like, oh, I'm expecting that something's going to happen. No, he was just waiting. He was waiting to do his, you know, get off his guard duty and get off that tower. He wasn't looking for anything. And like everything, and I want to say men do this a lot. They don't talk about this thing unless somebody asks them, because when
that's
he
true.
Said he started asking some of the other guards, other soldiers, they kind of like all kind of said, yeah, this has happened to me. I've heard something. You know, not all of them, but some of them. So, but they had nobody has said anything because I guess nobody wanted to be the odd man out and be, you know, like, oh, you're weird. What's wrong with you? But
yeah,
once he talked about it, then, yeah, that he realized that it just wasn't him that was having this experience, which is always a good thing when people are freaking out about things. So, now that, because you know, one of the areas, I know you wrote a bunch of books, that old Louisville, because I know that they have a big historic district there of the houses that they kept and they've you know, kind of restored, that were built like maybe around the turn of the century. A lot of it like is post-Civil War. Do you find that some of these, well, I want to say older areas that are further, a little bit further east in the United States, they have more rich history than when you go out west? Because you told me you just are finished doing the one for California, which is kind of like a newer part of the United States, kind of. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I guess, you know, the older sections like New England.
Uh-huh.
Or deep, deep in the South, Virginia, for example, or Georgia, I would assume would have possibly more ghost stories simply because it was a more populated area longer ago. In other words, more time for things to happen.
Right.
So that would be my guess anyway.
Well, even though of course, out west was when everybody was running around shooting everybody else.
Yeah.
But it was, it was a frontier, it was the Indian territory, and then as they pushed west, and they had all these boom towns or mining towns that sprang up, because of the gold rush and all these different things that happened out west. So I guess they have their own version of unusual things. So, Kevin, when you wrote this last book about California, is there any part, any area or any story in particular that you could tell us about that happened out there in California?
Well, I didn't get as many ghost stories as I would like.
Okay.
There's a lot of ghost stories from California, but I try to write stories that have not already been done so many
Sure.
times.
And that's difficult. I know that can be difficult.
So that ended up being a shorter chapter than I'd like, but I think it was kind of a funny chapter anyway.
Well, you know what? And I know exactly what you mean, because sometimes certain stories they're written to death about, like it's like, and after a while, that's also why I was asking you, because they have a lot of very well-known areas or towns that, everybody knows about, and then there's others, because you sound like you're a great researcher, and usually that's when you come across stories that nobody's ever heard of. And then when you read about it, you're like, wow, I can't believe nobody's ever, written about this event or this family or this house or this.
Well, I think those are the best
Oh, yeah.
stories. Yeah, I don't like to tell stories that have already been done too many times, and I try very hard not to tell the same stories in my own books. I figure if you're going to buy a book, you deserve, excuse me, you deserve 100% new material.
Sure.
The way that I find these stories anyway is simply by going through old newspaper issues, issue by issue, and making notes in a notepad about stories that sound like they might be worth writing about. And I write down the dates and the page numbers and little short synopsis of the action.
Okay.
And it's a good way to do the research because you can see how the stories develop with time and you can see how they end. And you can even see what happened after the
Right.
story officially ends because usually there's a little extra stuff going on that sometimes historians leave out.
Sure. Well, sometimes historians, they also, if for whatever reason, I'm not going to say all of them, but sometimes they slant stories a certain way because for whatever reason, they had their own personal belief about the events, and like you said, they include certain things but don't include others. And the newspapers usually, if it was a big enough story, you have more than one newspaper that writes about what happened.
Yes, it's true. And if you find, you can get the local paper on interlibrary loan, the local paper will almost always have more details that
Oh,
the
yeah.
bigger city papers don't have. So there's lots of ways to get good stories that no one else has done.
Yes. I personally think, because like I said before, back then the only thing that documented things like this was the newspaper. That was it. Or unless maybe like you said, somebody wrote a book from a historical perspective, but as far as when it was actually happening, it's, and I'm gonna use a well-worn example, which is Lizzie Borden and her murder trial. When you start actually reading some of the actual newspaper accounts that were written about what happened, there's a lot more different things than you see when, every time that they do some type of program on it nowadays, as far as her standing and what happened and how it developed and the trial and everything, like what you were describing, that there's details that makes you think it wasn't what you see on TV, in other words. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's very true. Newspapers are good sources, but I always find it's always good to get more than one if you can, because they
Yeah.
sometimes contradict each other.
Well,
And of
yeah.
course, we're always trying to beat each other with the latest, newest stories, so you'll find that the early accounts are often more full of mistakes than the later follow-up stories. So, again, it's always good to look at more than one source. Sometimes it can't be helped. One source is all you can find.
Right. Let me ask you something, Kevin. Do you find, and I'm going to ask you because it sounds like you've done a lot of research, that if the people that were involved in it were, how would I put this? Because I know back then, there was a lot of censorship in the sense of they just, they had to pick and choose their words when they wrote certain stories, especially if it was, the circumstances were a little bit like, eh. Where I want to say that articles were written using certain code words, or they even wouldn't write about if. And I'm going to give you an example, like that story about the Louisville couple that she was a prostitute, but it got written up because, of course, he was a very well-known part of a prominent family. She was also that she ended up being a prostitute, but when things happened, when they were on the lower echelons of society, that some of those things never got written up. Do you find that at all, or?
Usually the newspapers from the era, I imagine the libel laws were not as strict then as they are now, because usually they don't even use the word allegedly, for example, when describing someone who's accused of a murder.
They just they
They just
did.
give names, and it's true that they're kind of euphemistic about things, but if you read enough of the papers, you kind of figure out between the lines what a lot of the code terms mean. And you can figure, yeah, I'm sure even readers at the time could figure it out. They just had to use their imagination a little bit.
Right, because I know back then there was like a concern with not offending sensibilities, that kind of thing. And I have read some articles that it's like exactly like what you said. If you know what you understand what they're trying to write, but you could tell that sometimes I had to pick and choose their words when describing certain things. They would never use directly. For example, let's say instead of saying the word prostitute, they would use like fallen woman or something
Powerful.
like that
Yeah, the
because.
euphemisms there are just wonderful.
Things like that.
But you still get the idea of what
Oh
they
yeah,
meant.
of course, of
You can
course.
tell what they meant. They just didn't really come out and say it. It's really strange. They would be careful not to use words like that. But if they were going to describe, say, a murder scene or a suicide, they were incredibly graphic. In those days, they would describe every blood spatter, every bit of brain tissue, and where it was found sticking to the walls. So it's really strange to see that there are some things they were very, very squeamish about and some things they weren't.
I guess I want to make up for lack of photography. Like nowadays, we have an overabundance of it. Back then, it was like.
I guess so. Often they would use newspaper artists would simply go to crime scenes and they would draw pictures, which actually turned out to be very good, very accurate pictures. But because they weren't reproducing photographs in papers, at least not until about the turn of the century, like you say, they would have to paint these pictures in words to describe crime scenes and what people looked like.
And I'm going to ask you your opinion because sometimes like I said, I've read some articles, some stuff just out of curiosity. You know what, we sometimes always think that Law and Order back in those days was like a jury of 12 men and almost that nobody really received justice. Like, and I look at some of these cases and they were pretty good at carrying out the law. I mean, enforcing it, in other words, or
I actually think
prosecuting
they
it.
were. I think they were pretty good at it.
Yeah, they didn't.
They certainly seemed to be a lot stricter.
Yes, they were,
Unless women were on trial, and then they seemed to get kind of squeamish about things. So Lizzie Borden, again, being the perfect example.
Let me ask you, do you think Lizzie did it?
Well, I'm quite sure she
She
did.
did.
There was no way they were about to hang a woman, so
Yeah, and she was a real churchgoer too. She was very
they just looked for any excuse I think they could think of to let her go, and
and you
they
know,
did.
and that's one of the things that when I was reading up on it, I was reading actually that they don't portray is she was always involved in her local church. She was going every Sunday. When she was on trial, they were behind her. But for some reason, once she got acquitted, they kind of like told her, don't come back anymore to church.
Yes, it's, I don't know, human nature, a very strange thing. They were all behind her when she was in trouble, while once she got acquitted, they sort of looked at each other and said, but if she didn't do it, then who did do it?
But just in case, don't come back.
And then suddenly it dawned on them, I think, although they never really said it, it had to be her. Right. And she was ostracized from church.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the part when I was reading, I was going, I never saw that in a program. That's really interesting because you think about it, and these are all these people that knew her very well. They had been going to church, which is like kind of a social thing. They kind of knew her well. They were behind her. But like you said, somewhere along the line, somebody started thinking, well, wait a minute. You know, who knows what they might have picked up along the way. I like you said, they didn't come out and tell her in her face, we think you did it, but we just don't want you to come back to church anymore.
Yeah.
I think that's another thing, and I don't know if you ran across it. Do you think that there were instances where women were the perpetrators of probably very horrible crimes and they were just overlooked because they were women?
I think it happened very often, actually. And several of my books have got cases where it seemed ironclad cases against them, and yet the juries were all men back then. There weren't any women serving on juries till I believe women had the right to vote, so that would have been about 1920 or so.
Right, because, and I think men had a hard time accepting the fact that somebody that was like their wives or their daughters or their sisters could do something like this.
There was this saying, you know, a woman couldn't do such a thing, even though they did do it many, many, many times, but they would always fall back on that excuse. So my books are full of cases of women getting away with murders they pretty obviously committed. Okay. In fact, in one of my books, I argue that what they really, really needed back then were women on the juries.
Probably.
Because they wouldn't have been so easily hornswoggled by these sentimental, chivalrous man who would not punish a woman for anything she did.
Well, I think that would especially hold true if it was something, because, you know, you've always seen a lot of women that murder with poisons, you know, or they, you know, stuff like that.
Usually poison.
You know, but women could very easily do something much more drastic than just poison, but it was, you know, even if it just like hit him over the head with something, and then, you know, finish him off. But like you said, that was really difficult for men to think, especially if she looked innocent, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
If she was young and pretty, she'd get off every time.
Those days are over.
Yeah, my books are filled with cases like that. It's almost a running joke, in fact, if you read enough of my books to see how often this happens.
Really?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what I think is so interesting because, you know, a lot of these historical true crimes, like there's a set that always gets publicized, Lizzie Borden being one of them. But then there's a whole set, which is what you've grown across and what you've written about, which, you know, are not notorious for some reason. And then you see this trend, like you said, when you look at X amount of them, then you say, wait a minute, she did it. And did you run across any cases? Because, you know, and I think this happens to men and women, but especially women, where they end up killing somebody because for reasons of passion, because they hate the man or the whoever they killed. It's not premeditated. It's not a serial killer kind of killing.
Yeah, just
They're
sort of
driven
a,
to it, in other words.
Yeah, crime of passion, heat of the moment.
Do you find that was more than that, or did you come across some that it was like, you're just killing because you just want to kill this person, period, even if you're a woman?
Plenty of both, actually. Plenty of both.
Yeah.
And usually in the cases where it was a crime of passion, a heat of the moment thing, mm-hmm. Killing some seducer or something like that, in cases like that, they almost inevitably got off.
Okay. Were there some that...
Even in cases where they did it premeditatedly, the juries usually find some excuse. Usually what they would do is they would declare the woman insane and let her off on an insanity plea.
Okay, wow.
Because they just didn't want to face any other sort of verdict, any sort of punishment.
Do you think that, which is what I was going to ask you, did you come across anywhere, which is, I guess you answered the question, where it's evident that this person did it, where they lessen the sentencing because the evidence, it was just they couldn't look away, but when they came to sentencing her, they either acquitted her or gave her.
Acquitted or found a lesser charge, manslaughter, second degree murder, insanity plea, something like that. Very often, very often. In fact, I would go so far as to say that was usually the case.
Really? Because now, one thing I do have to say that I think that though once that happened to you, man or woman, but especially a woman, you better like go change your name because that kind of that taint would follow you around. That was like, you're
Yeah,
lucky.
they get off legally, but of course, getting off socially is a different story. And again, Lizzie Borden, perfect example. She was acquitted, and then everyone in town turned their backs on her.
She's another one I can never understand. Supposedly, she ended up inheriting and was a wealthy woman. She stays in this town where everybody is looking at her, thinking you killed your parents, whether they deserved it or not.
Yeah, just
And I never
sure.
got that part about her. I would have like sold that house and gotten out of town and go live somewhere else.
I would too. Maybe it was just stubbornness or something. I'm not really sure. Her sister lived with her for several years, and then eventually she moved away because she couldn't stand it anymore.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know. She was just, I don't know if she, like you said, maybe stubbornness. She wanted to just prove I could, you're not going to drive me out. Who knows what went upstairs with her. Do you think, well, and that's another thing I've noticed that back then, contrary to what happens now, that they can follow you and know every name, people kind of could move around and take on new identities. And
Much easier. No social security numbers, no DNA.
so,
You could, it was quite simple to move off a few hundred miles away and change your name and change your identity.
and nobody would be the wiser because, again, there was little or no photographs of people. It's not like now.
Unless somebody just happened to recognize you, you had a very good chance of getting away with it.
Or starting, which sometimes when we were talking about earlier about some of these people that killed and then they stop and then maybe later on. As a matter of fact, there was a case. This is a much more modern. I want to say it happened during the 60s or the 70s into the 80s, and it happened in the Northeast. I can't remember now where. This gentleman was even a minister at his church, and he killed his three children and his wife.
Oh, John List.
There you go. And
John
they
List.
find he tells everybody that they're leaving on vacation, something like that, and they find everybody dead like a month later without him. And they catch him what, like 20 or 20 something years later. He's
Yeah,
reinvented
because of
himself.
unsolved mysteries. I think that was in New Jersey. But yeah, he moved like out west, if I remember correctly, and changed his name and his identity, and he got away with it for 20-something years until he was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and right away someone in his new town recognized him.
And it's what's really that it, that this is the part where that I think that once they profiled him, they said, you know what? He because he was an accountant. This is the thing. In his first life, in his he was the paragon of virtue. He was an accountant, married, three children, very active in his church, and apparently his life was going downhill all of a sudden. So he decides to cut off the I guess what he thought was dead weight, kills his kids, all three of his children, his wife.
I think
They're
he
just.
killed his mother too.
Yeah, I know he was like, he decimated everything. But then when they catch up with him, he's still an accountant. That's, I
I
think,
guess
that's
it was all that he knew,
right.
or at
That
least all
they
that he could
profiled
do
him and
for
they
a living.
said, you know what, because of his personality, he's probably going to be doing the same type of work, and that's exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, it was pretty eerie. But yeah,
And
that's a good example of somebody, even in modern times, managing to get away with a new identity for many, many years before being caught.
well, they think also that the fact that he had like a month's head time because he had set up that scenario where they were leaving town on vacation. So they did not discover his family dead inside the house for like 30 days
Yeah, he
before
was
they.
very clever about it.
Yes, that they basically, like, he was able to set himself up and totally just disappear underground. And you know, one of the things, and I asked myself, and luckily I've never been in that position, but and I'm sure, Kevin, maybe you ask yourself, if that it makes you think, if you're living with somebody like this for many, many years, that it never crosses your mind that this person is capable of killing you and your children. I don't know, there's something in me that tells me there's got to
That's a
be
scary
something that tips
thought.
you off.
It does make you worry somewhat, doesn't it?
Oh, no, no, but okay, I'm going to give you another example. This guy, that BTK killer, the guy that, well, he's still alive, he's in jail.
Yeah,
Okay,
Dennis
but he's
Prager.
another one. He's a code enforcement officer. He's very active in his church, family. Turns out, he's been killing people horrifically for all these years.
He was a really interesting case because he stopped.
Yeah. He stopped and.
Usually, the conventional wisdom is the serial killers don't stop unless they are stopped by getting killed themselves, by getting put in jail or whatever, but he just stopped.
Well, see
And he
this.
didn't move either. He stayed in the same community for years and years and years.
Right, and this is the part I'm thinking to myself. Didn't his wife? Doesn't anybody like ever get a hint? God, I don't
He
know.
was good at hiding it, obviously.
But I can see where your neighbors, they're thrown off for years because at the end of the day, maybe you just talk to him a little bit, hi bye. Even though he had a rotten his neighbors did not like him at all because psychopath that he was, he would ride around with his little code enforcement book and make everybody's life hell in that
Yeah, he was
neighborhood.
sort of a bully. I
Yeah.
mean, maybe he quit killing, but he still kept on pushing people
Yeah.
around and trying to manipulate them in a completely legally acceptable way.
Right, yeah, of course. Let me take my little rule book out and
So
just drive
maybe
you
that was his way
insane.
of sublimating his wishes.
Yep. But to me, I've always had a hard time getting that thing where, I'm not talking about because there's some families where things, the murder takes place basically within the first 5 years of the relationship. But then you see these other ones where they're married 20 something years, have children, and somewhere along the line, you never, something never happened that you're thinking, this guy's just too cold-blooded. And by that, I mean, not that he would do anything against you or were the police, but that you realize this person has a remorse problem, as in he doesn't have any. I always have a problem with coming to terms with how people just either overlook it, or I don't know what to call it, because.
Or they don't notice it. People see what they want to see.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. But yeah, it makes you wonder how many of these murders or true crimes took place, and the person just basically that never got caught. Contrary to what everybody wants, the that moment of punishment, some of them lived into old age. Okay,
Well, I
and
think so. I mean, obviously, the best serial killers are the ones who never got caught.
nobody knows about.
And the ones that we don't even know, perhaps, that they even exist.
Exactly. And they just got what they wanted. As a matter of fact, I'm gonna tell, and I don't know if you've heard about this guy. He to me, I when I read his story, he's a pretty modern serial killer. His name is, or was, I'm sorry, Israel Keyes or Keyes. I don't know how they're pronouncing it. And he got caught.
Oh,
He was a young guy.
Alaskan, I think.
Yeah, he lived in Alaska.
Alaska, yeah.
And that guy was really, well, he was really scary. And he eventually got caught. Let me tell you something, he was planning out murders years ahead of time. And when I look at that, I was like, he was so organized that it was really, really scary because even this guy, the BTK killer, he basically got caught because he didn't realize when he printed something out that the computer, in other words, technology got the better of him. But this other guy, he got a little bit sloppy, but some of the things that he did are like, wow. And I'm thinking to myself, if you took that personality and you put them back 100 or 120 years in the past, I could see where people like that could kill for years and years and years and move around and do this and do that and grow to old age and nobody would be the wiser.
Oh, I'm sure many of them did.
That
people have just got this idea somehow that there weren't very many serial killers till the 1970s.
Right. It's just I
don't really think that's true at all. I just think the 1970s was when they got a lot better at recognizing them.
Right, at profiling and certain, you know, certain personality traits or, you know, whatever that goes into.
It's like saying human nature suddenly changed in the 1970s.
No, I think that.
I'm sure not.
No, I think that there's been psychopaths or sociopaths. It's just that, like, again, DNA, forensics.
Yeah.
I think sometimes if you had.
Cases now.
You know, if you had a certain title, like if you were a doctor, you got away with things. You know, people didn't look hard at you, or if you had came from a certain family or money, you know.
I think probably before the 1970s, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, there were plenty of serial killers, but there was no name for them, and they were, if they were on the move, or they changed their names, changed their identities, there was really no easy way to track them.
Yes. Well, the stories that you write about, like, I think you see it up close, you know, especially what was documented by the newspapers, which is those things did happen. People were getting killed, and or they did horrible things, and people, like, sometimes I run across things where, you know, you always think of people back then, like, eloped and left their husbands, wives. They ran off with other men. You know, you always think of it as that's a modern thing, and back then it happened.
Yes,
you know,
it did.
Where people would just up and leave with somebody else, and it wasn't always
very
the man.
Very hard to catch them.
Yeah.
Until a telegram was invented, and you could actually send messages very quickly from city to city, it was really, really hard to catch people.
Yeah. Yes, it was. It was. And but things like that did happen where, you know, we get that patina of the old times. Everything was the age of innocence, where people did, it was like, yeah, that's what you think. That people, you know, like you said, if they thought they could get away with it and just move somewhere else and change their names and fade into the woodwork, that's it. They would just.
A lot of people did it who weren't even murderers. They were just people would get really, really heavily in debt, and they just skip town and change their name and leave all those debts behind.
Well, I was I myself was doing research on something that happened here down in South Florida, and one of the pioneers of this little town. He comes down here, down to South Florida, which is the Everglades. This was like that, like, you know, the right before the turn of the century, 1900s, which out here was wild. It was a frontier, plus full of mosquitoes. He leaves his wife, I want to say it was either Georgia or North Florida, with four kids. Leaves them, just deserts them. Comes down here, pioneers, he's one of the little pioneer of this little town. Gets another wife, has more children, but he names them all the same names of the children that he left behind.
Did they catch
in North Florida? And I was like, are you kidding me?
He needed a little more creativity.
And I'm looking at that, and it was like, he just, you know, he just up and just left. I'm leaving. I'm out of here. Bye. I don't want to be a husband. But then he comes down here, and he had four children, and I think he had three more. I think he had a total of like seven children with his second wife. But the first four, he named for the same names of the four children that he left behind. And I'm like, what is that?
Was he missing them or something?
So, and he, you know, people did things like that. And, you know, what's really funny is, he was much admired in this town that he helped put up down the Everglades. And he was like one of the founding members, and he grew to be an old man and you know, and things like that. And when you look at his past, it was like, okay, there you go. So, and you're right. I guess when things got really crazy, the next thing you know is you're gone. You're out of here. And I mean, especially if you would go into one of these big cities like New York or any of these places in the East, where there was a very high population.
Really hard to catch people.
Yes. Let me ask you something, Kevin. Did you run across any more stories where the victims, it was based on ethnicity or anything like that, where looking at it from a modern perspective?
You mean where the
Well,
killers
like
were.
exact for example, that one, the Axeman, they were it, oh, my little dog's having a moment here. They were
Oh.
they, it was t going it was like a really little dog. That's my little Chihuahua. She gets away with everything. She's
Oh.
12 years old. She runs the house. But anyway, where it was Italian, Italian families. Okay. And like you said, maybe his problem was that he was Italian himself and he had this thing going on in his head where that's the victim he wanted. Did you run around against other cases where it looked like, maybe they didn't get it back then, but now that you look at it, you realize that they picked that certain victim based on their culture or their ethnicity or something like that.
Well, it seems to be the case with most, not all, but most serial killers that they do pick people of a certain gender, a certain race, a certain look, even. The way victims wear their hair, for example, there's just something about that particular look that they're after.
Wow.
So that's probably true of most cases.
Yeah, that there's something that in particular. Did you ever do any research about, I don't think they caught that one either, which took place in Atlanta, and I think the majority of his victims were black women, and he the same thing. He there was a bunch of them that were killed, and then it just stopped. And
Do you remember when this was? Was it
I
in the
want to
18?
say 1912. It was after the turn of the
Not
century. It
sure.
was
I
early.
might have something about that. I've got these really, really extensive files on these things.
And
So I should look that up. I seem to recall I do have a little something on that, but I don't think he was caught.
right, no. It was never solved, and he slew a bunch of women. Like he was really savage, and it was like, and it's exactly like what you described, a bunch of killings. Unfortunately, because of the times and that they were black, they weren't really being paid attention to, and then all of a sudden it just stopped. He killed a bunch of women savagely, and then it stopped. And again, it makes you wonder, did he leave town? Did
Possibly,
he
or
go to
was he caught?
jail? Did he get killed?
Yeah.
Sometimes I even think, and here's me like going off, and it makes you wonder if some of these perpetrators are even they get like what I call justice at the hands of somebody that says, I'm gonna get rid of you and I'm not gonna let anybody know. I know it
Yeah,
was
I
you.
wonder. I wonder if it's ever happened. Very likely it has.
I'm not gonna let anybody know, or I'm not gonna go through a trial with you or anything.
Yeah,
I know
and
it's you.
somebody saying, I know you did it, I can't prove it, but I'm going to see to it you never do it again. And
The
just make it look like a killing and a robbery or something, and no one would ever know. It's probably happened at least once.
reason why I say this is that you especially in the frontiers town, not so much I think in the east where that you had the bigger cities and you had a more established law, but where sometimes people that they were accused, they basically the law had to beat away lynch mobs, okay, because they were ready to execute this person. Forget the trial. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what? This probably played out in certain circumstances where it wasn't a mob that showed up. It was somebody that they kind of like said, I know who you are. I saw what you did. Something along those lines. And it was like, I'm going to lynch you. Not lynching technically, but gotten rid of this person. Who knows how, and just buried him somewhere or whatever, dumped his body. Who knows what,
Yeah.
and
I would be very surprised if it never happened.
well, as a matter of fact, the other day I was, what was it? I was surfing on the internet, and I had seen this before, but it was like, and this happened like, I want to say the 1890s in South Dakota, and this was, one of those gold town boom towns for the gold and everything. Anyway, this guy works for a couple who have a restaurant, and he gets fired But I guess he realized while the time that he was there that they kept money. It's those times where people would live above the...
Really, really weird you should bring that up. That happens to be one of the stories I'm working on for my Western book.
Which one? Is it going to be the same one?
Yeah, that's that story.
I
totally recognize it. Off the top of my head, like I say, I can never remember details.
Uh-huh.
I think it was South Dakota.
Yes! That's it! Oh, my God! Kevin, what a coincidence! I was reading that. I was like, what?
We ran a restaurant, and he was a colonel, and they fired this guy.
Right.
Just like you say. But he remembered they had money stashed away in a trunk or something, so he came back and he broke in. Apparently, he didn't really mean to kill the woman. He just wanted to break in and steal the money. But she surprised him, and in a panic, he killed her and her dog and stuffed them in a food locker. And the next day, a waitress found them.
You know what? This is the part where, like, the research comes in. I just read something. Knowing you that you've read, you know, this is the only version I read was that, yeah, that he goes in there knowing that they keep money, okay, and she's still in bed, and that supposedly he had taken a cleaver from her kitchen.
Yeah, that's it.
And that her dog is barking, and that when he's trying to kill the dog, not her, but somehow or other, he ends up hitting her here on the, basically between her, on her forehead, and almost takes the top of her head off. According to him, that his defense was he really didn't mean to kill her. He was trying to get the dog, which he still ends up killing with a butcher knife. But do you really think? I just think he wigged out when she maybe woke up or something or found him. Let's face it, she could identify him.
Yeah, I think so. The thing that made me interested in the story, because, you know, it's, I hate to say an ordinary kind of murder, but it's sort of an ordinary thing, you know. A guy breaks in, he kills someone out of a sheer panic. What made it interesting to me was the fact that the sheriff actually allowed her husband to be the hangman.
Oh, my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I just happened to find that newspaper article.
Isn't that crazy?
He wanted her then. She said, let me hang the guy. And the sheriff said, okay, sure, why not?
See, and that was one of the things that, from what I understand, when they arrested him, the law had to, like, stand guard because the people at the tower were ready to lynch him. It was, forget the
yeah, they were about
process
to,
part.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, I didn't know that.
Yeah, wow. That was the detail that made me say, oh, good story. I'm going to do this.
I think that is a great story, and I see now what you mean, especially when you get all that extra detail, which, you know.
Well, it was an interesting thing. I found other accounts of it, but only one of them mentioned the fact that her husband was actually the hangman. And that's, as I mentioned earlier, it's always good to try to find more than one source, because you'll always get stuff out of one source that the others don't have. And that's a good example.
Can you imagine this man?
Strange you should bring that up, because
isn't that weird?
Your case that no one's heard of, and you've actually read about it.
Yeah, because to me I can't remember now how I came across it, to be honest with you. But sometimes you surf around and one you click somewhere, and then before you know it, you're reading something. And
well, as soon as you said out west, 1890s, man and a woman who ran a restaurant, I said, oh. Yeah, I just wrote that up like a couple of weeks ago.
And I think that, well, let me tell you something. Talk about that husband getting some type of, what do you want, I guess you want to call it, some type of justification, something out of it that he was able to actually hang the guy, you know. And
it's the only case I know of in history.
That's
where
incredible.
A widower, a spouse was actually permitted to hang the person who committed a murder.
Think about it. I guess the law said, why not? Well, it's going to hang anyway. Well, and that's another thing. Ow, now that you brought that up, I read that, you know, usually, you know, back then, you know, the gallows, you were supposed to snap your neck.
Yeah, that was ideally.
But that in his case, he didn't. It took him 25 minutes to strangle to death.
I think that's correct.
Which, from what I understand, sometimes they would do that on purpose. You know, kind
sometimes,
of.
But not. Usually, when that happened, it was a mistake. But I do know of one hangman who actually would do that on purpose.
Well, I've heard that.
He's not long in the job, but he actually would do that.
Right. I've heard that, yes, that sometimes it was like that you had a hangman who didn't know how to tie the noose, like a certain, you know, the words, you know how they would tie them a certain length so that when the person would drop.
Yeah, and the knot always had to be behind someone's ear.
Right.
So that's one thing you see in the movies that they actually get right.
But I've heard of other circumstances where purposely the person was allowed to strangle. We're not going to let you just hang and snap your neck. We're going to let you strangle because they knew that it would take X amount of time.
Extra punishment,
right. And I wondered, when I read that, I said, God. And now that you told me that thing about her husband being part of the hanging party, wow. See? That's me thinking over time that I wonder if that was like a purposely done to let him suffer for 25 minutes.
Possibly. The source didn't say that, but that is possible.
Yeah.
Sometimes hangings were just simply bungled. Sometimes, mm-hmm. though, well, it's kind of a bizarre topic, but sometimes bodies have muscular spasms even after death. So sometimes these guys were hanged and killed instantly, but they would just sort of jerk around in the air, and it looked like
right.
that they were alive and strangling, when in fact they were actually dead.
Yeah, that the muscle spasms.
Yeah.
Well, to me it was like that. They noted on there that it was a 25-minute thing. Isn't that the same thing? I said, you know what? I can imagine that, yeah, you know, you're going to have the spasms in the body and, parts of the body that are still... But I think 25 minutes is a long time.
Yeah.
Especially when you have a town that really wanted to, like, make you this guest of honor at the necktie party even before going to court. Yeah. I don't know. See, that's... But I think that's so interesting. What a coinkydink.
Yeah, I know. That's really strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not a famous case, really.
No, it's so not. It's not.
Really, really surprised that you just happened to bring that one up.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you added in there just gave it a slant I didn't know about because, you know, I guess back then at that point they were thinking, it's who cares what it looks like if we're allowing the victim's husband to, like, do the hanging part. He's going to die anyway, so forget it.
Yeah.
You know, like you mentioned back then, sometimes the proprieties, it was like, especially if it was one of these frontiers towns, they didn't worry about that, what it looked like.
Yeah.
And also back then, I believe that they would execute people publicly. It wasn't like...
Yeah, that actually didn't really come to us. Well, it depends on the state. A lot of states did away with public executions sooner than others, but for a while there, almost every state had public executions.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it was, to me, I see it as, when I would think of that, I'm thinking, okay, this serves two purposes. One, you know, everybody seeing justice being done. Two, psychologically, you're intimidating any would-be killers. Guess this is what's going to happen to you if you kill somebody.
Solid deterrent.
You know,
who knows, maybe it worked. I mean, there's no way really to tell, but maybe it worked.
Well, think about it, you know, especially
I think they should do it, but
well, from what I've seen, especially like in these, with these, they call these gold rush towns, where you have a bunch of people that would go in there trying to make money, a lot of them were really kind of unsavory, and you know, I imagine the law had a really hard time keeping everybody in line.
Yeah, I think out west that was a lot more common.
Yeah, so, hey, yeah, attend the hanging, by the way. I hope you take note of what happens, what we do here to people that murder other people. You're going to end up swinging on a rope, and everybody's going to see it.
After a while, they started having hangings in prison yards, and the public was no longer allowed. But even then, most jails were located in communities, and people would climb trees.
Yeah.
Or get in tall buildings and, you know, pay a top dollar for a top window so they could look out and see the hanging taking place anyway.
Yeah, I've heard that, like you said, that this was like an event. This was people would travel from out of town sometimes.
They'd come from other states.
Yeah. It was like, oh, it's an execution. Yay, let's go.
It'll just be black with people coming to watch hangings. They'd climb trees. They'd climb telegraph poles.
Yeah, I heard that even people that had houses, they would sell, like, or on their balconies, they would basically make money.
Yeah, they'd sell balcony space and window space. Yes. So you'll see this occurring several times in my books, too.
Where the execution of this person became
public hangings and crowds turning up.
Can you imagine? And I guess the more notoriety there was involved with the murder or the trial, the more people came in from all points.
Yeah.
You know, so much for that thing that us modern humans are the bloodthirsty ones.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that? We like to think that we're not, that we are, that other people weren't before us, but they were. There's photos to prove it.
Yeah, sure, of course. So, Kevin, now that you said something, are you going to work? I know that you still said you've got this book coming out for California and maybe a couple of months, and then another one. What are you going to do? Are you going to stay out working the west end of the United States, or what are you going to do?
Well, there's actually two coming out in August. One California and one the Midwest.
Okay.
Nebraska, Kansas, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, places like that. My book about the South came out a couple years ago from Pelican Publishing, and it's called, Gothic and Strange, True Tales of the South.
Okay.
Then I'm working on two right now.
Oh, you
one
are?
One of them is a New England book, which I hope will be out next year, but also, as I mentioned, a Western book.
Okay.
In other words, all the Western states except California.
Okay. All right. There was plenty going on out there. You know, people.
I'm hoping they'll both be out next year.
Yeah, and it's really funny because you mentioned that, you know, imagine the eastern states or the eastern cities where you had a well-established judicial system. But I've seen some of these western states, when you read some of these stories, you could have a guy that was a gunslinger one day and the deputy the next.
It's true. Yeah, it happened all the time. Bat Masterson.
Wyatt Earp, didn't he also, they all like,
I think John Wesley Harding actually worked as a lawman for a while.
Yeah, because you would get appointed, I guess, or I don't know if you got appointed or if you got voted in, but I guess back then, if you had a bad reputation, not too bad, but bad, especially if you had a rough town, you were like, you're the man we want. So you kill a couple of people. Okay, that's all right.
Yeah, exactly. Work for us.
Yes.
You're fast with a gun. That's what we want.
Yes. You know, and I know in some cases, especially when they had like what they call those cow towns, where they had all these people coming in with the cows and the cattle, that things could get really wild in some of these towns as far as murders and fights and you name it. So they needed somebody that was, you know, what's gonna bring everybody into Wild Bill Hickok. That's the one I was thinking about.
Wild Bill Hickok. Most of the towns out there would have a few hundred rowdies and only like maybe 3-4 lawmen.
It's like, who wants that job?
Not enough officers to handle that many people. So I guess they just felt they had to make an example out of some people.
Yeah. Well, you know, there goes that. But anyway, so okay, and you're good. You're great, because let me tell you something. So let's say now that you've got two books coming out, you're planning two more, and what is it? You just work X amount of hours per day, or how do you do it?
Well, because I teach classes, I usually work on them a little before class or between class.
Okay.
If I don't have any papers to grade, but most of the writing I do in the summertime when I don't have any classes.
Oh, okay. Which were right.
So I just do huge amounts in the summer, and then I do all the little things and touch-up work the rest of the year.
Okay. And I imagine, I can think that if, I mean, if I find interesting stuff on the internet, I imagine that going through all these newspapers, you must find so much stuff that you're like, okay, I'll leave this for the next book.
I do. Yeah, I try to keep some good stories back because I never know when I might need them for something else.
Sure, sure. But I think that, you know, that sometimes history, the way it's written, is not entirely accurate, if you know what I mean.
And you realize, it's always, best to get more than one source if you can.
Yeah.
And that's, you get two or three, four sources, even if they contradict each other a little, you can generally figure out what happened.
Well, you know, I know when you're looking for stuff, you're looking at crimes and when people are not behaving the way they should, and that doesn't mean everybody was like that. But
bizarre things in general. I keep tracks on all kinds of topics I find interesting. Excuse me, even topics that aren't particularly strange, because you just never know when some of that knowledge might be useful.
Well, that's going to tie into something else. Absolutely. Kevin, thank you so much for spending this time with me. In the credits of the show, I am including the link to your website. I have put in slides of some of the latest books that you have out now, including the one from California that's coming out, The Axeman from Hell, you know, all of those. But I know that you've written a lot more books. Okay. So, like I said, if people want to, they can just go to that link on the credits to go directly to your website.
Oh,
and
great.
Also on Amazon, I know that you've got the books, you know, the ones that are available anyway, they'll be on there.
Should be. Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I love this. I love those stories. You know, this is, you know, as much as I like the ghost stories and everything I do, especially from that time period, you know, the Victorian type ghost stories, Dickinson, all that stuff. I do love the true crime from that age because, like you said, some of the things you come across are so bizarre. And so unlike what we're brought up to think of what took place during those times, where people were very circumspect and Victorian morality and blah, 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 and not really. Not all the time, anyway.
Well, they're very dark topics, but I try to write them up in a way that's at least a little lighthearted and humorous to try to take the edge off the darkness.
But you know what? You made a very good point, Kevin. It's human nature, you know, and humans are humans now, and they were humans then. Okay. And I think sometimes people did get away with certain crimes the length of time they did because people didn't want to look at certain aspects of people doing horrible things. And that, you know, again, it still happened.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you so much. I'm going to be following up on that book.
Okay. Thank you very much.
The one from the South Dakota, it's coming out. It's one of the ones you're working on right now?
It's one I'm working on now, and hopefully Indiana University will accept it. If they do, I think it would probably be out next year.
Okay. I got to follow up on that one especially.
I'll get it out one way or the other.
But that one, because that was just too much of a coincidence.
That was pretty weird. That was very strange.
Yes. And knowing the kind of research that you do on this stuff, I definitely want to see what you write up on that.
Well, thank you.
Because that is... Let me tell you something, that was pretty horrific, and I don't buy the thing that he was trying to kill the dog.
Yeah.
If my mistake hit her across here. But
that would have been terrible aim, wouldn't it?
And I'm telling you, I don't know why that duck stuck around. Anyway.
No, me either.
Take care, Kevin. Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
It's been a wonderful, wonderful interview. I'll be getting in touch with you, okay?
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Take care. Have
okay,
a good Sunday.
Too. Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye. Can you tell I have the I love this kind of interview face? Yes, that's what it's all about. He's written, you know, like he said, the majority of his books mostly deal with what they call true crime. You know, true crime placed back then. You know, he does have some paranormal ghost stories, you know, within the stories, but the bulk of them. But let me tell you something. I read some of his stories, and he writes wonderful, wonderful, because you could tell he he does the diligent part of the resource of the research, but when he writes the story, it's like a story. It's not like he's just spitting facts out at you. It's like a story, and they're entrancing. They're just this is I'm telling well, this is me. This, you know, this is the kind of book that you start reading it, you know, and then before you know it, it's midnight, and you're like still like, oh, I gotta read this next story because it sucks you in, especially if this is the genre that you're into, which is true crime, unsolved crimes in some cases, because like he said, there were certain things that never got solved. And I mean, we could go on and on for that. And on the flip side of that is like, you know, the psychopathology of serial killers and things back then, and well, now it's being profiled, but again, these people that never got caught, did they die? Did they go to jail? Did they move to another part of the country? Or one of Marlene's theories that somebody knew what they did and said, I'm gonna get rid of you. I'm not even gonna let you go to trial. And that's it. They dropped off the face of the earth, and basically they were 6 feet under someplace in some field, or they were dumped in some swamp, you know. Let me tell you something, that not so much east, but out there, the lynch mobs happen. If you got caught doing something, which it was pretty obvious you were the one that did it, the townspeople didn't want to wait for you to go to trial and then to pull in a judge. They wanted to bring justice their own way. And if you think that a lot of them just waited for the lynch, nah. But anyway, I think all those stories are super interesting. Also, because looking at it from a paranormal slant, okay, you could see so easily how these stories were the source of hauntings. Whether it was the person that was victimized or the killer or the place where it occurred, I mean, it could have a different versions of it, and sometimes nothing comes of it. But anyway, you know, as far as if we go by that paranormal paradigm, sudden violent death, unresolved, no justice for the victim, you know, these are all the ingredients that a lot of paranormal experts say are the underpinnings of intelligent hauntings. So, I mean, if you want to go a step further, even though basically what he's describing is all these crimes and, you know, in some cases, and I think that sometimes it was pretty obvious who the victims were. But considering back then that there was no DNA, no forensics, sometimes no communication even between, I mean, if you don't think there's communication now sometimes between police departments here, back then, even if they were adjacent, where there were other killings, other victims that were never brought in or tied into this set. I mean, it could go on and on from there. That's why when I read these stories, which I love, I extrapolate all these versions of what happened outside of what was actually reported. So again, I urge you just check out Kevin McQueen and all his books. Let me tell you something, you're gonna love his style of writing. It's fantastic. It is fantastic. Anyway, guys. I hope you like the show. I hope you're going to subscribe to my channel and you're going to hit the like button. And again, I want to thank you all very much for coming and looking at the show. And I hope that you're going to come back every week and you're going to look at what's the new topic or the new person, or to see me running around trying to run down some paranormal location or some work on my Ovilus. Again, also, please hook up with me on Facebook and on Twitter, because I do live stream on both of those social media outlets when I'm out in the field. So, Sunday for me, guys. Have a great Sunday. As a matter of fact, have a great summer. Just became summertime. So, have a great summer. Take care and be safe. Thank you. Bye-bye.